are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann, and this edition of the New York Times Magazine is the health edition, and it's focused on body changes. I'm going to start with an article featured, the featured article on the cover of the magazine. The picture on the cover is of a large woman's rear end encased in tight black pants. Her arms are hanging by her side. She has tattoos on both insides of her arms and long fingernails. And the title is Butt Lifts Are Booming. Healing is No Joke. Beauty, pain, race, and money play out in Miami's post-surgical recovery houses. Story by Sandra E. Garcia. When Randy Wright got a Brazilian butt lift in 2020, a complex surgery in which fat is liposuction from the abdomen or lower back or other fleshy parts and used to enlarge and shape the buttocks, she knew she couldn't afford the most expensive post-op care. She underwent the same procedure a year before, traveling from Atlanta, where she lived, to Miami, where the prices were lower and the options were abundant. For Wright, getting these surgeries alleviated the insecurity she felt about her body after having two children. "She changed my life," Wright said about her surgeon, bringing a finger to the inner corner of her eye to catch a tear. "I couldn't present myself anywhere in the body that I was in." After her surgery, she needed somewhere to stay and be cared for during the first 2 weeks, the most painful part of the recovery period. The outpatient facilities to which hospitals sometimes refer people, which can be costly, were out of the question. She could go it alone and rent a hotel room where she could convalesce in private and sustain herself on room service. But on Instagram, she found a world of recovery houses, many of them decorated in millennial pink, hyper-feminine aesthetic, where she would be healing alongside other women who had just gone through the same procedure and would be cared for by a team of women who would cook for her, dress her wounds, and monitor her progress until she was well enough to catch a flight back home to Atlanta. Wright chose one of the recovery houses and had such a positive experience that she decided to start a similar business of her own. Within months of leaving, she became the new owner of Dream Body Recovery in Miami, which has three rooms that can accommodate up to six clients. Being a part of this journey with other ladies, knowing how it changed my life, that's my why, she told me. I just love to see the transition, the growth. Dream Body Recovery is just one of countless recovery houses that have cropped up in Miami, which has become the heartbeat of the BBL boom in the United States. The average price of a BBL nationwide is around $5,000, according to the American Society of Plastic Surgeons. But when I spoke to Dr. Angelo Cusolina, a cosmetic surgeon in Tulsa, Oklahoma, he estimated the cost of the procedure in which patients receive high-quality care to range from $6,000 to $15,000. Patients in Miami can get the butt-enhancing procedure for well below that price, however, and many choose to spend the money saved on additional procedures like liposuction in the arms or thighs. In 2021, there were 61,387 buttock augmentations, which include both implants and fat grafting, according to the Aesthetic Society, a professional organization and advocacy group for board-certified plastic surgeons. The BBL trend in the United States started in Miami, no doubt, no question, and then spread to other parts of the country, said Michael Sauzauer, who is more popularly known as Dr. Miami. I think the reason is because of the influence of South American culture. It's called the Brazilian butt lift, not because it was necessarily invented in Brazil, but you think of Brazilian women having, like, you know, perky butts, bigger butts. American women are also traveling to places like Colombia, the Dominican Republic, and Mexico, seeking even cheaper surgical and recovery options. Competition breeds lower prices, Salzhauer says. In some cities, you might only have two surgeons that do BBI. So if you're one of two surgeons in Cleveland, you can charge a little bit more for people that don't want to travel. Lower-cost BBLs in the United States are often performed by cosmetic surgeons instead of plastic surgeons. Plastic surgeons are required to have years more surgical training than cosmetic surgeons in freestanding surgical clinics. Women have increasingly opted for buttock augmentation procedures in recent years, according to practitioners, a surgery that has grown as fast as any other cosmetic procedure in recent memory. It's probably one of the biggest increased procedures as far as the last 10 years, really, Kuzalina says of the BBIL. It was booming. The numbers were huge, increasing like crazy. For black women, many of whom have always possessed a version of the BBL body, it's difficult to square this popularity with the fact that their natural bodies have been denigrated for generations. When the modern beauty standard embraced a more exaggerated hourglass shape, a microscopic waist eclipsed by a large round bottom, butt augmentation surgeries that help women achieve this look were propelled into the mainstream. Evidence of the BBL is ubiquitous on social media. There are even surgical offshoots, read the skinny BBL, for folks who want a more natural looking but still noticeable plumping. A natural looking but still noticeable plumping. And in many ways, the idealized body, one that was considered unattainable for anyone other than celebrities, is now technically possible for everyday women to achieve. And black women aren't immune to wanting a seemingly quick way of acquiring the figure that defines desire today. Everyone says that you should wait because your body doesn't fully come in until you're like 30. And I'm 20 years old, and why am I going to wait until I'm 30 to be snatched? Katira Northrup, an exotic dancer from Rhode Island, said, many of the women I spoke to felt that they needed to achieve this look before they could feel fully confident or get a loan or start a business. For women perpetually left on the fringes of the beauty landscape, there's a dark twist and serious risk to the length that they will go in order to realize this body. Lower-cost BBLs have created a market for similarly priced post-operative care. These are not the relaxing, spa-like havens like the ones that serve wealthier clientele. More often, this corner of the recovery house market is a place where the racial and class dynamics of the cosmetic surgical world collide. The photographer Nayla Ruschel and I went to Miami in April to visit two recovery houses, Dream Body Recovery and Enchantress, where all the clients at the time were women of color. That butt augmentation and liposuction surgery are more accessible and less costly than ever makes recovery homes a thriving cottage industry among these women. Most recovery houses offer transportation services following surgery, often a minivan with the passenger seats reclined to make space for an inflatable mattress, where patients who are not supposed to sit down or lie on their backsides for at least 2 to 4 weeks can lie on their stomachs during the ride. When they arrive, the beds they've booked, usually two to a room, can cost anywhere from $80 to $400 a night. Some recovery houses have nurses on site who can check vitals and provide massages that they claim help with healing. But some women complain that they have experienced poor service and unsanitary conditions at recovery facilities. like toilets that don't work, and inedible meals. There are even social media accounts where women anonymously send photos of recovery homes that they claim falsely advertise their amenities. 65 complaints have been filed with Florida's Agency for Healthcare Administration, which oversees assisted living facilities, defined as any home or building where housing, meals, and non-medical services are provided for more than 24 hours to one or more people who are not related to the homeowner or facility manager. The agency doesn't have the power to specifically regulate or license post-operative recovery homes. In fact, it's only made aware of the existence of recovery homes if a complaint comes in. This is particularly problematic because BBLs have among the highest mortality rates of any cosmetic surgery. A whole host of things can go wrong. Most notably, the repurposed fat can travel through veins in the buttocks to pulmonary arteries and chambers of the heart, causing fat embolisms. Transferred fat can also migrate beneath the muscle, tearing gluteal veins. According to some recent surveys, for every 13,000 BBLs performed in the United States, one results in death. Kalani Wright, a 24-year-old from Mississippi, wanted to have Lipo 360, a procedure that removes fat from all areas of the midsection, and a BBL last year. But she became pregnant. When she was finally able to have the procedures, she said that the pain was worse than childbirth. Before she went into surgery, Kalani made the doctor promise that she would make it back home to her 10-month-old. When she woke up from anesthesia, she recalls saying, "Thank you, God," loudly over and over. The clinic staff asked her to silence her praise because she was scaring patients in the waiting room. Despite the risks, the popularity of the BBL procedure continues to swell, and it appears that the demand for the recovery houses and the subsequent need for more regulation will continue to grow alongside it. When we visited Enchantress, the woman who ran the facility pulled her Chrysler minivan up to the front of the home with a woman lying on an inflatable mattress in the back. Another woman dressed in scrubs waved goodbye to the owner as she walked out of the house. She's been shadowing her to learn how to open her own recovery home in Miami. Sandra E. Garcia is a reporter for the New York Times on the style desk. Nalia Ruschel is a photographer and a director based in New York. She's recently working on a series of still life images inspired by a recent visit to Jamaica, the island nation of her birth. And another article featured in the health issue about body changes, the feminist case for breast reduction. My body had been objectified for as long as I could remember, so I decided to change it. This is a story by Melissa Phoebos. The waiting rooms of plastic surgeons hardly resemble those of traditional doctors' offices. Instead of fluorescent overhead lighting and plastic chairs, they have patterned wallpaper, wood floors, and floral arrangements. In the autumn of 2019, I waited for one consultation on the Upper East Side under a crystal chandelier beside a mini-fridge where patients could help themselves to petite bottles of Diet Coke and Perrier. Another had crimson window dressings, marble tables and red upholstered chairs, a boudoir-ish setting that both disconcerted and comforted me. This was the office I decided to return to after my initial consultation. On my second visit, I was grateful to find the exam room was the standard medical white with its crinkly papered table and glass jars. The surgeon joined me, accompanied by a wordless young female assistant with immaculate makeup. He was tall with a sort of lewdly handsome face, full pink lips and sleepy blue eyes. I was learning that my preference was for surgeons whose looks struck a dry and sexless note. The silent woman handed me a gown and gestured to the curtain corner of the exam room. It was absurd to disrobe behind a curtain and don a robe simply so that I could walk out from behind the curtain and open the robe for him to examine me. But I still appreciated the theatrical privacy. My breast hadn't been touched by a man in a very long time and had never been studied by one under such harsh light, or any light at all, without the mediation of desire. I stared at a random spot on the wall as I stood with the robe open, my naked breast prickling under his scrutiny, my mind willfully blank. His study complete, the surgeon snapped a photo with a camera that he plugged into a desktop computer. My torso appeared on the screen like a disassembled mannequin, bright against a black background. My breasts were even bigger than I imagined them, teardrop-shaped with wide purple nipples. As the surgeon moved his computer mouse, they changed shape. With a twitch of his finger, they rose on the disembodied torso and shrank into breasts I had fantasized about for more than 25 years. Till age 11, I was a confident, athletic child, tanned and strong. I played barefoot all summer in our rural New England neighborhood and took pride in the bruises and scrapes that mapped the days across my limbs. Then my breasts arrived, huge, heavy, and first among my peers. They marked the before and after of my body, what it meant in the world of people, and what it meant to me. My transformation inhibited me both physically and socially. I couldn't run anymore, partly because it was uncomfortable. Sports bra technology had not developed enough to bind a chest like mine on a body my age. But moreover, because I couldn't be seen running, I stopped playing sports, stopped playing outside altogether. Worse, I was dogged by boys and loathed by girls, and soon developed a reputation as a slut. At first, this was solely because of my breast, but it worsened when I reluctantly yielded to the boys who wanted to touch them. Sexual attention could be alluring, but the specter of pleasure was a mirage. Afraid to rebuff that which it invited, I consented to acts that overwhelmed me and was relentlessly harassed at school. Over the next 25 years, my breast drew attention that I wouldn't otherwise have received. Like a sexual beacon, they signaled to men everywhere. I'd always known I was queer and began dating women as a teenager. While I found some refuge in these intimate relationships, I still lived in the world of men, and the size of my breasts meant that my body was theirs for the staring, commenting, grabbing, and fetishizing. Most women contend with being sexually objectified, but not all start at 10 or 11 years old. By the time I was 12, my body felt like a disguise that I couldn't take off. For most of my life, I desperately wanted my body to be different, and I also understood the obsession as a shortcoming, as a failure to be a real feminist. I thought that I needed to accept my body, to love my body, and find it beautiful to successfully reject the internalized messaging of the patriarchal culture. My shame signified a personal failure at this. Never occurred to me that my problem was also material and social. I could accept and love my body entirely, and men would still yell at me out of car windows, grope me in public, make assumptions about my intelligence and sexual availability. My perception of myself could never be entirely sealed off from other people's perception of me. In the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders 5, body dysmorphic disorder is classified with other obsessive compulsive disorders and defined as preoccupation with one or more perceived defects or flaws in physical appearance that are not observable or appear slight to others. BDD causes clinically significant distress or impairment in social, occupational, or other areas of functioning. The definition of the word dysmorphic, however, elides the element of misperception. Its origin is the Greek dys, bad, ill, difficult, abnormal, and morphe, form or shape. Though the words are often used interchangeably, it's a crucial distinction. To suffer from a misperception of the body as malformed and to suffer from a malformed body. One is a pathology, the other a practical condition. In a way, I suffered both, though the category of malformed bodies becomes more opaque the closer you examine it. It becomes possible to see a body's malformation as that of the society it inhabits. In 1993, People magazine featured Soleil Moon Frye, a former star of the television series Punky Brewster, on its cover. Teenage plastic surgery, read the headline. Frye, who was just 3 years older than I, had gotten a breast reduction, going from a 38DD chest to a 36C. I couldn't sit up straight without people looking at me like I was a prostitute, she told the reporter. I'm just loving myself right now. I'm finally free to be the teenager that I am. Frye and I were the same height, but her breasts were larger than mine, which were a 36D. Though I would have given anything for the freedom to be the teenager I imagined I could be with smaller breasts, I didn't even consider the possibility of a breast reduction. I was certain that I would have needed a real deformity to justify even entertaining the suggestion. Frye's size apparently qualified. Gigantomastia, the magazine called it. No, I was sure it would have been the ultimate act of body hatred, a self-mutilation on par with any other form of pathological self-harm, not to mention the frivolous expense. My family was not rich. I grew up in the 1980s and 90s, thumbing through my mother's issues of Ms. and occasionally attending Now meetings with her. Despite never having read any feminist writing on cosmetic surgery, I knew that the consensus was, as Kathy Davis, the foremost contemporary feminist theorist on the subject, wrote in a 1991 article in the journal Hypatia, that cosmetic surgery was regarded as an extreme form of medical misogyny, producing and reproducing the pernicious and pervasive cultural themes of deficient femininity. The woman who yielded to the desire to commit such violence to her body was a cultural dope, afflicted by false consciousness, believing she made a personal choice while actually yielding to a system that controls and oppresses women. When I was 15, friend's mother took us to see Gloria Steinem speak at Brandeis University. During the Q&A, a trembling young woman stepped up to the mic and asked Steinem if it was okay for feminists to shave their legs. Steinem, who had giant glasses and a chic blonde bob, laughed warmly and told the audience that she was often asked this question. She said that foundational to feminism was the belief that women ought to be able to do whatever they want with their bodies. Relief washed through me. I had already been tormented for years by the seeming conflict between my love for high heels and makeup and the second wave feminist belief that such trappings were complicit in patriarchy's oppression of women. Years later, I found plenty of loopholes in my inherited feminism that permitted me to do things I would have thought off-limits at 13. But none were big enough to fit cosmetic surgery. Even by my early 20s, the only people I knew who'd done it were friends who worked in the sex industry, for whom it seemed a professional investment rather than a personal one. I would need a more powerful kind of permission that I didn't yet feel the authority to give myself. The idea that my breasts weren't irregular enough to warrant surgery has a history longer than mine. The distinction between respectable plastic surgery and aesthetic surgery has been made for almost a century. As the writer Elizabeth Haken explains in her 1997 book, Venus Envy, A History of Cosmetic Surgery, the modern practice of plastic surgery didn't really begin until it was reborn after the First World War as an art and a profession. Practitioners said it was a medical response to the crisis of warfare and chose the term plastic surgeon to distinguish themselves from the practitioners they called beauty doctors, and claimed the term plastic surgery to differentiate their work from what they variously called featural, beauty, cosmetic, or aesthetic surgery. They didn't want to be mistaken for the doctors who advertised in the backs of women's magazines and experimented with paraffin injections, a precursor to contemporary fillers that yield catastrophic results. One clinical professor of surgery at Johns Hopkins stated in 1927 that a beauty surgeon works strictly on a commercial basis and saw the patient's personal satisfaction as the only yardstick by which his work was justified, whereas the plastic surgeon would be willing to operate only when the deformity was sufficient to justify it and when he knew there would be real improvement. It was, in other words, a noble service to reconstruct wounded soldiers' faces, but a disgrace to alter the bodies of women who had not been deformed by such crises. Being an ugly woman, or simply a woman who experienced her body dysphorically, was not a crisis on par with battlefield disfigurements, disease mutations, or congenital anomalies that had clinical names like a cleft palate or gigantomastia. Surgery has always been a field dominated by men, and plastic surgery most of all. In 2020, the American Society of Plastic Surgeons estimated that women make up 92% of all cosmetic surgery patients, while a 2017 study found that only 20% of board-certified plastic surgeons were women. It's fitting that the most well-known autobiography of a cosmetic surgeon, published in 1953, is titled Dr. Pygmalion. Its author, Dr. Maxwell Maltz, characterizes himself as an aesthete and an artist. Like Ovid's sculptor and Shaw's Henry Higgins, he delights in his ability to shape women. Quote, "I could whisk new noses out of the air. Just about everything lay within the compass of my magical powers." The tone of his memoir reminded me of two of the most popular cosmetic surgery-themed television series, the reality concoction Botched and Ryan Murphy's Nip/Tuck, which both feature male surgeon duos who sculpt their female patients' bodies with an eroticized relish. That it was and continues to be up to the most likely male surgeon to determine when the deformity was sufficient squares with our general belief in the expertise of trained doctors, though you can also see it as a way of prohibiting women, and later the gender nonconforming, from claiming sovereignty over their bodies. We live in a visual culture, a culture whose hierarchies are most often assessed through the way we look. All I ever wanted was to lead with myself as I knew myself, not with my breasts and all that they connoted in the eyes of others. I wanted some agency in determining how I was perceived. I have since read this described as bodily invisibility, the privilege of assessing the world directly, without significant mediation or interference of others' assumptions or biases against one's body. I knew that as a woman, I was permitted by social conventions to modify my body only in certain ways. I could get manicures, shave and wax off half of my body hair, maintain a hairstyle, exercise for hours daily, and wear makeup. My conception of feminism also permitted me to cover myself in tattoos, pierce just about every flap of skin on my body, and stretch inch-wide holes in my earlobes, as well as have them sewn back up 10 years later, a permissible deformity to have corrected. To change my body, though, through cosmetic surgery would violate the often conflicting ideologies behind these allowances. Elective surgery was unnatural and irreversible, perverting my God-given form in too extreme a fashion. The supposed dichotomy between medical and aesthetic surgeries is reflected perhaps most starkly in today's medicalization of sexual transition, the manner in which transgender people seeking surgery must pathologize their experience in order to receive permission from medical gatekeepers. Listening to the experiences of my trans friends and reading the works of trans writers pushed me to think differently about my own dilemma. Julia Serrano, writes in Excluded that in our culture, feminine appearances are more blatantly and routinely judged by society than masculine ones. It's also driven by the fact that connotations such as artificial, contrived, and frivolous are practically built into our cultural understanding of femininity. This particular form of sexism is instrumental in the trans-misogynistic double bind, wherein trans women are faced with the pressure, in addition to their own personal desires, to have surgery in order to prove their femaleness and assure their physical safety, while they're damned post-surgery for the perceived artifice of their gender. The process of laying bare the internalized prescriptions for what I should or shouldn't do with my body began to strip them of their power. Winter of 2018, as my wife and I were driving home, I said, "There's something I wanted to talk to you about, but I'm not ready yet. I just want to put it out there. I think it might be ready soon." One of the biggest reasons I hadn't considered cosmetic surgery was that it would require an acknowledgement to another person that I suffer because of the way my body looked. The prospect of saying it aloud had always seemed unbearably vulnerable, an exposure of my own weakness. In my mid-30s, however, I had found myself considering it anew. I actually hadn't thought about a breast reduction for years. I still experienced all the familiar discomforts, the exercise and fashion inhibitions, the phobia of any lovers seeing me stand naked with the lights on, the fantasies that I might simply wake up with a transformed body. But I'd grown used to accommodating and tolerating them. I still thought about my body a lot, but less than ever before. Growing older had changed me. It was no longer important or realistic to strive for a particular kind of unattainable body. In my mid-30s, I could no longer choose to go hungry nor exercise with my previous fervor without risking injury. Also, I cared little what men thought of me anymore. This, along with my age and the reduced frequency with which I dressed in clothes that drew their attention, was probably a factor in their lessening attention. I wasn't sexually harassed on the street anywhere near as often as I had been in my 20s. I also cared a lot less what hypothetical fellow feminists thought of me, partly because I knew that I had few actual friends who would judge me if I decided to get cosmetic surgery. One day, I simply asked myself, would I do it if I didn't have to explain myself to anyone? The answer was a resounding yes. Did I truly believe it would improve my life? I knew with gut certainty that it would. I had considered surgery an impossibility for so long, consigned myself to tolerating the discomforts. It took me a long time to change that way of thinking, although the realization happened instantly. I didn't have to live with it. It seemed suddenly absurd that I had been privileging hypothetical people's imagined opinions over my own daily ease and happiness. Summer before I made the first appointment, my wife and I spent an afternoon in a private room at a bathhouse in Port Townsend, Washington. And that's where I told her about my decades-long struggle with my breasts and my interest in surgery. I'd never spoken aloud about it to anyone. When I started talking, I couldn't look at her face, but that changed as our conversation progressed. She supported me entirely in whatever decision I made, she said. I felt immediately relieved. My fear had nothing to do with her, after all. It was the fear of that 11-year-old girl who had no words for her experience and had not found them for 25 years. When I told the story for the first time, I stood in a warm bath as steam rose around me. My voice echoed against the tiled walls. It felt like a kind of christening, my words naming something that had not fully existed before I spoke it, and that naming had finally made mine. It was a bizarre sensation to look at my breasts for the last time. There'd be some of the same tissue, yes, and a new nipple cut from the old one, but the breasts I had spent so many years wishing different, their particular weight, would be gone forever. In the surgical theater, the body is sacred only to its inhabitant. It did sneak up on me, the strange feeling of sacredness, as my surgeon squeezed and measured and scrawled on my breasts with a marker on the morning of my surgery. When I had my earlobe sewn up at 32, I didn't feel a thing, not physically or emotionally, until I stood up afterward and looked down at the metal tray of tools beside my surgical bed where the little gray lumps of my earlobes still lay, like two chewed pieces of gum. "Oops," surgical assistant said, "I'm not supposed to let you see those." She folded them in green paper that lined the tray, which she then crumpled and threw in the steel waste bin. It tugged something in me, maybe my body's basic instinct to keep itself intact. I suddenly wished I had asked to keep them. On the morning of my breast surgery, I was glad I wouldn't have to see my discarded parts thrown in the trash. I was also glad for the sweet nurses, with their impeccably made-up faces and lilting voices. I was used to being in majority female spaces. These were often full of feminist queers and trans and non-binary people. The surgeon's office was unabashedly feminine and steeped in the cozy assumption that everyone who entered was on the same page about beauty, how to define it, and sure that they wanted it. Every time I stepped off the elevator, I felt like an interloper. If they had glimpsed my hairy legs, I would have felt guilty, exposed as a feminist Judas in deep cover. I found it an oddly comforting space. The implicit consensus precluded any tension in the atmosphere, and I found that I had no desire to challenge the doctor when he said things like, "They're going to be so much perkier and more youthful," or when one of the nurses squeezed my wife's shoulder and promised her, "You're going to love them." Which is all to say that the culture of cosmetic surgery offices, and perhaps the industry as a whole, aligns with the second wave feminist take, an endorsement not only of patriarchal beauty standards, but of patriarchal social structure. I understand the temptation to extend this assessment to the patients who elect to participate in the industry. But while writing this essay, I spoke to a number of self-proclaimed feminists who felt no loss or regret about their surgeries, from thigh lifts to tummy tucks to vaginoplasty. Overall, the prevailing emotion was one of triumph and pleasure. It seems clear to me now that any feminist position on cosmetic surgery that doesn't take women's relationships to their own bodies into account actually objectifies them. I hated my body for years, felt both obscured and exposed by it, and subjected to many acts that others wanted irrespective of my desires. These cumulative burdens had consumed an inestimable amount of time and energy. In large part, they had defined my relationship to myself, all the years of therapy and recovery and writing and reading and conversations with friends had changed that. I no longer hated my body. My experience in the world no longer felt so defined by my corporeal form. To physically change my body felt like an important way to concretize that work. It was not, as some might assume, a substitution for psychological change, but rather a physical consummation of one that had already taken place, a ritual commemorating my reclamation of my body once and for all. I didn't want it to be a subtle process. Despite the consideration of women's lived experience with cosmetic surgery, feminist theory still largely considers it problematic, a way of trading one terrible suffering for a less terrible suffering. The choice is being to continue to live in a body that feels unbearable or to undergo an abhorrent violence. The assumption is that no one would choose bodily violence unless it was to alleviate unbearable suffering. This is simply not true. I say this not only as a former professional dominatrix, but as a person who has long understood that most forms of healing include hurt and many include violence. As one often hears in 12-step meetings, pain is the touchstone of all spiritual progress, and choose pain should not be mistaken for self-hatred. And chosen pain should not be mistaken for self-hatred. While writing this, I had a conversation with a friend who suffered from dysmorphia as an adolescent and described having a face that drew negative responses from people her whole life. She decided to undergo elective facial reconstruction in her late 30s. She told me, "I wasn't concerned with the improvement so much as I was concerned with having a literally violent, cathartic experience where I would go through a tremendous amount of pain and reconfiguration. And by doing that, I would reclaim ownership of my body and of my face from every single opinion about it." In her words, I recognized an element of my own experience. My surgery had not only been a medical process, but also a spiritual one, and the violence of it had been key to that. When I fasted the morning of the surgery and donned the surgical gown, it felt ceremonial, a rite marking not only a physical change, but a metaphysical one. My wife and I remember the days of my convalescence after surgery like a fabulous vacation, because never on any of our vacations have I relaxed to such an extent. Perched in a nest of pillows on our couch, I sipped seltzer through a straw and ate saltines for days while she picked the movies and brought me my medications. I had never touched myself more tenderly than when I washed those wounds for the first time. My adaptation to this new form has amazed me. There is a period of trying on all of my clothes and discovering new freedoms. I can now shop online, wear bras without underwear or no bra at all, sprint without clutching my breasts, and wear a fitted t-shirt outside without getting honked at. But 6 months after my surgery, I already felt accustomed to my changed shape. Now, more than 2 years later, my wife and I still occasionally joke about my modest bosom, but I hardly think of it. I'm happy with the physical results, but more notable, I enjoy the absence of that familiar preoccupation. The assumption about cosmetic surgery is that it'll give the patient something she didn't have before, but I've found the greater gift to be what it removes. My body's meaning has consolidated and is less contingent on the perceptions of others. I had always experienced my body, particularly my breasts, as something I needed to keep hidden or to manage. In the first weeks after my surgery, I couldn't look at myself in the mirror because the sight of the incisions made me woozy. Instead, I asked my wife to look and tell me what she saw. I stood, opened my shirt, felt like baring myself to the sun for the first time. How warm it was. How quickly I had stopped treating my body like a terrible secret. It was less the physical alteration that made it possible than the conversation we had in that steamy room and the decision that followed. Naming my experience returned my body to me more conclusively than a scalpel ever could. Melissa Phoebos, the author, is the author of a recently published book, Bodywork, The Radical Power of Personal Narrative, as well as the essay collection Girlhood, which won a National Book Critics Circle Award. Now I'll read a letter and answer from The Ethicist by Kwame Anthony Appiah. A great friend of mine was the donor for my baby. At some point, I know my daughter will ask about her father, and I'm not sure how I will answer her question. While her biological father supports us in many ways, he doesn't wish to play a parental role. I want to respect his wishes, as the greatest gift was his donation. If my daughter inquires when she is older and my friend still wishes not to be identified, my plan is to explain that I procured a donor and that that person is anonymous. Am I doing the right thing in disclosing only select information to her? I fear that if I tell her that her father is someone in our lives who wishes to remain anonymous, she'll have difficulty understanding. But ultimately, my approach may be flawed because DNA testing and Google make it easier for people to find out about their biological parents. How do I do the right thing by both my daughter and my friend? And Anthony writes, some people believe that all children have a right to know their biological parents and should, at any age, have access to them. The trouble is that when we speak of rights, we often think of prerogatives or constraints that trump anything else. In reality, though, clashes regularly arise between different rights and between different rights holders. Compromises must often be found. Most of the rights to privacy, property, expression, and more aren't absolute. Just too many things matter to us and beckon for protection. And when we come to the prerogatives of parents and of children, we soon run into complications. There are cases when a sperm donor has been awarded paternity rights because against the will of the mother, or deemed a parent against his own will, and ordered to pay child support. What, for that matter, about the woman who becomes pregnant after being raped by a stalker? If a rapist learns that his crime resulted in a child, he is permitted, in some states, to sue his victim for custody. What about cases when adoptees were severely abused by their biological parents? And is there a role for safe havens when newborns are anonymously relinquished? I can tell you that in some villages in Ghana, babies born with disabilities can be viewed as bad omens, and safe havens save their lives. All this is far afield from your own situation, but because there's so much absolutist rhetoric about knowing our parentage, it's worth contrasting the high-beam clarity of the polemicists with the chiaroscuro of ethical life. From conversations over the years with people who have been adopted, I know that many feel that they need to know their biological parentage and that some simply don't care much about it. This is distinct from the practical interests we have in proper access to family medical history, which in principle is information that could be secured while maintaining confidentiality. Yet the argument has been made that knowing one's biological relatives is inherently important for the formation of an identity, wrongly implying that children who, for whatever reason, don't know their ancestry are somehow defective. Still, I'm glad that open adoption is emerging as a default, albeit an overridable one, and the time may have come to rethink our norms regarding sperm donation, too. I would add that in a better system, we wouldn't rely on donors' self-attestation for medical histories, donors should grant access, even if anonymously, to later diagnoses that may have familial significance. Genomic analysis hasn't yet obviated family medical history. Again, if the only thing that matters is the child's right to know, your quandary is immediately resolved. But there are considerations on both sides here. A perplexity in your case is that your daughter exists only because you promised the donor privacy. While she's still young, you can tell her the truth that her biological father was someone who made her life possible but didn't want anyone to know who he was. Promises, you can explain to your daughter, are a serious business. Without them, many human arrangements like your daughter's birth wouldn't happen. If she really wanted to know who he is when she's older, try to persuade your friend to change his mind. But if he doesn't, and you simply renege on your promise, he could decide to withdraw from your lives altogether. I hope he does reconsider over time. Your daughter, he should realize, is not bound by the promise you made. When she's old enough to do the sleuthing, all you can tell her is that you hope she'll take into account his wishes for privacy. But at this point, it's out of your hands. And were she to learn who her father is, she would discover that other members of his family, including people who might welcome the connection to her, even if he didn't. It is much help, I know, to tell you that you should have sorted out these issues with your friend before proceeding with the donation. In particular, you should have at least tried to persuade him that his identity could be disclosed after his child reached a certain age. A child's potential interest in knowing her paternity deserves very serious deference and should have been given more weight earlier in the process. But the agreement you made with your friend means that you've accepted the obligation to withhold his identity, and he's the only person who can free you from that obligation. And I'll read Judge John Hodgman on pickle liquid. The sarcastic and brilliant judge responds to letters. A couple disagrees on how to store their provisions. Frazier writes, "My wife, Michelle, drains the brine from pickle jars, fresh mozzarella, and anything else with icky liquids, then puts them back in the fridge. I am happy to provide photographic evidence. To date, there have been no illnesses resulting from this, but I think it's gross." And the judge writes, "I don't want to see your disgusting photos. I've seen the results in my own fridge after pouring out a little pickle juice to enjoy as a bracing shot. I am sympathetic to your wife's aversion to eating foods from shared tubs of finger water. Every dirty martini from a public bar is a sewer. She may have even learned to love the taste of dried out Moz balls and limp pickles. But she's still wrong. Store them as the manufacturer recommends, and get a pickle fork, the kind you use to grab pickles, not the tool used to separate ball joints, which I just learned about. Thanks, search engine." I'll end with a poem called Joint Custody by Ada Limon. Why did I never see it for what it was? Abundance. Two families, two different kitchen tables, two sets of rules, two creeks, two highways, two step-parents with their fish tanks or eight tracks or cigarette smoke or expertise in recipes or reading skills. I cannot reverse it, the record scratched and stopping to that original chaotic track. But let me say I was taken back and forth on Sundays, and it was not easy, but I was loved each place. And so I have two brains now. Two entirely different brains. The one that always misses where I'm not. The one that is so relieved to finally be home. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.